Welcome everyone to Productivity Book Group. I'm your host and facilitator, Ray Sidney Smith. Thank you for joining Productivity Book Group. This is our third and final discussion for Making It All Work by David Allen. We'll be discussing the second half of the book, Getting Perspective, as well as the final two chapters, Making It All Work in the Real World, and In Closing. So I wanted to start off the conversation today by welcoming everyone, of course, and then talking about the GTDQ, the four quadrants that David Allen created for purposes of making it all work. And so this is sort of jumping back to page 62 of the book, at least the hardcover version that I have in front of me. But he talks about the crazy maker visionary quadrant, he has the captain and commander quadrant, victim responder, and the micromanager implementer quadrant. This is a perspective on the vertical axis and control on the horizontal axis. And I was curious if anyone on the line relates the GTDQ to any of the other work you currently do. For example, I spend much of my time relating my work to Maslow's hierarchy of needs, that is, Abraham Maslow's self-actualization pyramid. I find it a practical and sort of psychologically sound relationship to my system. And so the question, again, is do you use the GTDQ or any other model to give your tasks and projects and higher levels of focus a relationship to one another? So I'll go ahead and start with Tom. Tom, do you have any way that you sort of create or add glue or webbing to the different pieces of your system?
Well, from time to time, I loosely use the old Covey quadrant system of the urgent, not important, not important, not urgent, that particular quadrant one. I don't use it on a systematic basis, but I use it sometimes.
Right, so that's the Merrill Covey matrix, and so you use the quadrants 1 through 4 to be able to identify whether something more or less important to you or less important.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Wonderful. What about you, Denise?
You know, I've used it a couple of times recently, as a matter of fact. You can go online to David Allen's site and take the little quiz, and it ends up and says, okay, you're in victim mode today, Denise. But then I went back and took it about 8 hours later after I'd cleared everything out and done my weekly review and took it again and said, okay, now I'm back into master and commander. So I did use it. I found it pretty handy.
That's fantastic. That's a really cool use for it, like, you know, literally on using it in the course of your day as part of your practice. That would be really helpful. I think I might actually try that one sometime. And how about you, Nick? Do you use any other kinds of sort of frameworking for yourself in terms of, you know, meshing perhaps the GTDQ and so forth?
I too sort of sometimes use the Covey quadrants. Since reading the book and doing these calls, I've been using the GTDQ a bit more. And specifically the idea that I can transfer between quadrants and that's okay, and embracing that a bit more. You know, I think I was always trying to have everything perfect, and, you know, moments when I'm not at the top of my game, I sit back and say to myself now a bit more after reading this, okay, this is okay right now, I'm in the weeds, and I can get back to captain and commander later. So that's been a helpful way for me to think about things. And that's a relatively new thought that I've been having.
Okay, cool. Yeah, it's interesting to hear everyone's sort of perspective here. Definitely the Merrill Covey matrix is a great solid piece. I actually just read something the other day about meshing the Covey concept of the weekly compass with the weekly review and some other items that were online. I'll try to make sure I put that on the show notes. And it's for me interesting because I come from a psychology background, and paying attention to how these particular quadrants relate to prior materials, say a Myers-Briggs or Enneagram or whatever it might be. And in this particular case, I really see the quadrants and the Kiersey temperament disorder, you know, that concept of Professor Kiersey's concept of having social styles and how people fit into those particular social styles. So it was a little obtuse when I first read it, trying to figure out where and how it related to that. And I actually remember writing, you know, in the book, how does this actually relate quadrant to quadrant to that? And I think I found a comfortable place of looking at it from a Maslowian perspective, you know, that if you're moving up and down the self-actualization pyramid, you can sort of find out where you are. Am I in victim and responder mode because I'm really dealing with my lower levels of the pyramid? And then as I'm making my way to the captain and commander, am I moving up into the higher horizons and therefore doing more things that are directly related to the higher levels of my world? And so, which are, of course, things that are going to provide me with greater joy, contentment, and happiness. So, well, moving right along, I don't know if anyone has any thoughts about Chapter 12 and the runway. I didn't particularly find myself in it with any major questions about the runway when I came to Chapter 12, but I was curious about folks' thoughts on the run, what David Allen had to say about the runway. And, you know, I think that it makes a lot of sense. I just didn't particularly have anything that really jumped out of me from that chapter. I feel like it was sort of a summary of those things. I'm curious about other people's thoughts on what was sort of said in that. He outlined each of the Getting Perspective chapters with scope, typical format, how and when to engage, and then, you know, some other particular parts in the chapters. But he tries to give you an ability to sort of have that same structure within each of the chapters. Did anyone have any thoughts on Chapter 12 in terms of the runway and next action? Did anything jump out at you? I know that he always gives sort of the questions at each of the horizons, and so when it came to the runway level, he asked the questions, the typical questions, what is it and what's the desired outcome? In essence, you know, when you're on the runway, what do you need to do? And I thought that was a really good way for him to outline those sections of the book. He basically allows you at each level of the book to ask these primary questions whenever you need to ask yourself those primary questions. And so I wrote them all down, actually, this rereading, so that I have all of these sort of areas, these questions to ask in each of these areas so that I'm able to go back when I need to. But any thoughts on Chapter 12? I don't want to glaze over it if there's really some meat that someone pulled out of it. Okay, well then we'll move on to Chapter 13. So Chapter 13 is Getting Perspective at the 10,000 foot level, which is project. And so my question for everybody is, how often do you review your project list? I'm curious about people's frequency in reviewing project lists. Of course, GTD says to review it at least weekly during your weekly review. And so how often do people review their project? I'll start off with Nick.
Sure. Ray, this is I do the weekly review, and I do review the projects then. I review my action list daily now, and I focus on my project list on a weekly basis for the most part, unless I do feel that things are moving more quickly on certain specific projects, I may need to boost the review frequency on those. That's how I'm handling it.
Great. How about you, Denise?
At least weekly. I have a set of construction projects that I usually review at least twice a week. So it's kind of based on what scope and what kind of projects they are, how often, but at least every week I look at everything. And then I'll hit some of the others during the middle of the week if I need to.
Very cool. How about you, Tom?
My projects are pretty granular, so I review mine about every 2 days or so, because my priorities and just my current, especially in my professional situation, is very fluid. So I live and die by my projects list.
That's very interesting that you say that, because my sort of follow-up question for everyone was really, you know, for projects that are due to be completed within a week, do you map out all the next actions for that particular project in that week and put them into your next actions list, the contextual next actions list? Do you put them in your calendar, or do you have another method for tracking them? So starting right back up at the top, Tom, since you had sort of noted that you live and die by your project list, how do you really manage those projects within the week? Are you referring to them on a day-to-day basis in terms of the next actions being fleshed out, or are you literally looking at the project and internally determining what those next actions are?
Probably the latter. I look at the project, keep that project in front of me during the day, and then in the moment trying to determine what that next action is if the project's moving really quickly and has a lot of moving parts. If the project's not moving real fast, and of course it's I don't have to refer to it quite as often. I'm more referring at that point to just like my usually it's a waiting for item that is keeping it from moving forward most of the time.
Mm-hmm. How about you, Eddie?
I think it depends on the project. I mean, if I know it's a week and it's going to be dependent upon other people, I'm probably reviewing it quite frequently and mapping out what needs to be done and what information I need back and when do I need it. If it's something that I'm not quite sure how I'm going to finish it, even if it has to be finished in a week, I may or may not map out all those action items all at once. So it kind of just depends on the project itself, what the scope is.
Yeah, that makes total sense, absolutely. How about you, Nick? So those projects that are due within a week, how do you manage those particular projects?
I am pretty wedded to keeping just the next action in there. What I will do is, in OmniFocus, I have the ability to put a due date on a project. So, and each day, sort of, one of the things I do as part of my daily review is review upcoming due things. So, anything that's due within the week, I'll see that if I don't have a next action for that particular project, I will capture that as part of my daily review. What I will do is if something is due in a week and has multiple steps, I will take some time to do some vertical planning outside of my GTD system. So that's what I typically do.
That's great. That's great. Yeah, for me especially, I have my project list, and the project list actually shows up within a week view in line with my tasks, my next actions that are going forward for a particular week. So if I have something due this particular week, then the next actions associated with it are in a calendar, our calendar date. So, if there are a series of six or seven tasks that need to be accomplished within a particular week, then they're going to be on the day in which they need to happen in order for that to happen. So, where David Allen talked about putting things into your calendar for day-specific tasks, since you can date the task within Remember the Milk and Toodle-Doo and other Wunderlist and other types of productivity software, I just do it in there. I don't put it in the calendar literally. And so, if I have a project that's due, I'll usually take the anchor next action and put that into the day in which I need to get it done. And that completion of the next action will trigger me to either do the next action after that, and if not, then I'll flesh it out on paper. I print out my next actions for every day, so the task list for the day is printed out. And so if the next action is associated with that project, I'm going to see that in my project list in the morning. And then that allows me to be able to pull the next actions associated with that from my mind and onto the paper. So I actually process live as I'm working on that project. Typically, that next action is the trigger for me to go ahead and do the project planning in the moment if I haven't done that project planning during my weekly review. So most likely I've done that project planning in my weekly review, and I have a couple of next actions that I presume are the next couple of steps to move myself along, plus any project support materials, anything that would tell me where roadblocks might be or if I need something else to pay attention to at some particular metric along the way. So So I tend to, like Nick was talking about, keeping myself in a next action list anchor so that it can move me forward. So I know that there's something to be done, but I try not to flesh out all of the tasks unless I really know it's a discrete task, a discrete project that has hard edges between tasks, and I know how I'm going to complete them. So if it's going to be a phone call, an email, and a document to be prepared based on those phone calls or emails, and I know I'm going to be able to complete that Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, then that's done. It's easy. I can put those tasks in the system, and I'm good to go. But if it's a much more fluid thing, and I know that it has to still be completed by Friday or by Thursday or whatever, then I'll make sure that it's in the system as an anchor, and just giving myself enough space, margin of error within my week to make sure that I can get that done. So moving on to the other premise that David Allen makes in Chapter 13, he has this really blunt statement. He says, the whole concept of work versus life and personal versus professional is nonsense, end quote. And I'm curious, what do you think about making it all work premise that distinguishing work and life from personal and professional is nonsense? Do you think that you blur those lines easily and comfortably today? I'll start with you, Tom.
I definitely blur those lines all the time and have for many years. I've never been a person like not to take personal calls at the office, as long as they're not too long. So if there's something that needs to be done at home or whatever, I've always felt free for my wife and family to be able to contact me and let me know if something's on their mind or something needs to be done. I've never kept separate work and professional calendars, so I definitely blur that distinction a lot. So I agree with David on that quite a bit.
That's very cool, and I think that's part of a good corporate culture that embraces knowledge workers and is aware of making that allowance. So that's really fantastic to hear. How about you, Denise?
I definitely blur it all together. Kind of like Tom, I don't keep separate calendars. I don't keep separate lists. My at-call list could be all kinds of floating all over the place, whether it's work or personal. It just needs to be, you know, that's what needs to happen, and sometimes you catch those people after the end of the day. So it'll happen when it happens during my day.
That's understandable. I mean, I sincerely deal with that quite frequently, where, you know, some of the personal things have to happen during the day, and therefore, you know, you have to make time for it in the day so that you can get everything done. And how about you, Nick? Do you find yourself blurring the personal and professional work and life thing throughout the day, or do you find that you have more distinction?
What I found is, you know, I think, you know, my friends and me, we and, you know, maybe it's just the New York City culture, but it's very hard to successfully achieve here in New York. Most people are sort of so gung-ho at work, and then, you know, it's a work hard, party hard atmosphere among me and my friends. And I'm not sure that everybody is doing a great job with the balance. So I think it's an area of improvement for me and for most people I interact with here in the city.
Well, being one of those people that you interact with here in New York City, I probably am a little bit guilty of the work hard part. And yeah. So I find myself in a state where I do, my system is one. You know, I think very similar to what Denise said in terms of it's not a blurred line, but I have one calendar. I have one, you know, those type of things. I use Google Calendar, and although I have, you know, multiple calendars within Google Calendar, it all is one, you know, for work meetings and so on and so forth. It all falls onto my primary calendar. And in terms of my tasks, those all are in the same system. You know, I use a project management system for the work stuff, but my next actions for both work and life are in the same space. What I think I find the most problem with is not having one system that is appropriate for my work and life. It's really finding more time for my personal life. I spend I hate to apply the word workaholism, but that probably is the appropriate term. I find myself in that state where I overcompensate. That's not the right word. I spend more time working than I do playing. I'm going to use mixed words. And I find myself in that state where I would love to spend more time in play mode. And at the same time, I have this conflicting notion because I feel like, I've done a podcast about this, sort of the, you know, a life work balance. And, you know, the idea that I don't particularly feel like I have a lot of trouble with working a lot because it feeds me. You know, the work that I do in the productivity community and the work that I do in my other, you know, hats in life, I feel like are great. I don't feel like I have to spend more or less time at work because someone's told me that I should only work from 9 to 5, you know. And so I feel like I'm in a good place in terms of life-work balance. It just happens to be that work takes up a much larger chunk of the pie than the other parts. But I feel like the other parts are really in balance. I feel like I spend a lot of time with my family. I feel like I spend a lot of time with friends when I can, and maybe not. Maybe I do want to spend more time with friends and, you know, spend more time with other parts of my horizons and those in my areas of responsibility. So, you know, there's always room for improvement, but I feel like things are, you know, not bad because I spend more time at work. I hope that sort of gives people a different perspective than perhaps people feeling like they're completely out of balance. Anyway, so this came to mind as I was reading chapters 11 through 14 this time around for a productivity book group, but fear is often a part of our everyday life, even though we tend to avoid recognizing it. If anyone's read The Gift of Fear by Gavin De Becker, he's not a psychologist, but he's a security expert, and he talks about, De Becker talks of fear as a gift that protects us from harm. And in essence, it's our intuition. He's really defining intuition for us in terms of, in this case, protecting ourselves. But in the case of GTD and so on and so forth, it's really in being able to deal with discomfort. And so do you intuitively look up or down your horizon to focus when you feel discomfort, that is complacency or tugging, you know, something tugging on your mind? If yes, how did you do it? Because I think that would be helpful for people listening. And then if not, how do you think you could make that a more automatic response in your work and life? And so to give you some time to sort of think about this, I'll say that from an intuition perspective, it's been many years of my time trying to evoke some level of intuition from my work. I'm a very left-brain thinker, and the idea of shifting things to a right-brain focus that is balancing out my thinking has been very difficult. And so what I have done is to what I call sitting with my discomfort, which probably came from a psychotherapist that I had from years ago. But it was the idea that you had an uncomfortable thought, and instead of immediately trying to solve the problem, you would sit with that discomfort. You would actually stay there in that place. So, for example, if you're on top of the world and have everything in the world, sitting there and just being present with the fact that you have everything, and so therefore you have a feeling of there's no more room to grow. And then if you're at the bottom of the world and you're struggling to put food on the table, and or you're in a meeting and you know that you have several competing priorities, sitting there with the, you know, the discomfort, that feeling, and just being mindful of what it feels like and where you are, so that you can just become comfortable with it. Being comfortable with discomfort is so important. At least it has been for me. And that, I think, has really unlocked a huge intuitive potential that I feel I have and have been able to use going forward. So with that, let's start with Tom. Do you feel like you use intuition in your world? Do you feel like you could use it more? If you do, how did you develop that intuition?
I was afraid you were going to ask me that first. That's a pretty heavy question.
It is.
Without getting too personal, I guess, my life is in a tremendous transition, having just relocated to New York from a very small town. And before I moved to New York, I was unemployed for several months, and all the joy and excitement and problems that entails. And so, yeah, I was spending a tremendous amount of time looking at these different, horizons and perspectives, because when you're in between careers or in between jobs, especially, your jobs define you so much that you have to look very carefully at or keep yourself from becoming discouraged, because so many of us identify ourselves with our careers. You know, that's such a large part of our identity. So, yeah, I was having to go up and down those perspectives quite a bit. I was having to make some pretty important decisions about either keeping a relatively low-paying job during my unemployment just to kind of make ends meet, as opposed to quitting that and finding something else that gave me time to get out and apply for work and that sort of thing, and managed to find a wonderful opportunity when I did that, kind of a leap of faith. So, yeah, incredibly long story short, I depend on my intuition a lot. Because it helps to keep me centered, I guess. It helps to keep me aware of where I'm headed. Wow, I've been all over the place on that answer, but that's kind of where I go with it. So yeah, I think intuition is so important. And of course, David Allen always talks about how, you know, you set your priorities and you determine your next action that you're going to engage in is based primarily on your intuition.
Absolutely. Well, I think it's incredibly brave of you to share that. Thank you. That I think it's very helpful for people listening, especially to the podcast, and of course all of us here on the line, to really understand how intuition can pay off, and you made an intuitive reaction to a situation, and it certainly has paid off, and I think that's great. Congratulations. That's fantastic. So,
thank you. I hope it is helpful to everybody out there.
Absolutely. I certainly think so. I think every storage of encouragement is helpful in some way, shape, or form. So definitely. How about you, Denise?
Oh, I think it's incredibly important. I don't know necessarily how you gain it. I think it's just there somehow, or practice maybe. As far as being calm in the moment, I'm in the process right now of really looking up and down and left and right, because I have some responsibility changes that are going to affect some other choices that I've made. And I'm going to have to probably do the punt projects, because things are not going to work. There's just not enough time in the day. And it's really hard to look at some of those things and try and decide which things I'm going to have to let go and which things I want to hang on to. But I know in the next few days I got to make a decision, because otherwise I'm going to be going crazy, pulling my hair out.
Well, we don't want you.
So I'm hoping the intuition kicks in.
Well, I hope so too. I think it's really important for people to know that when it's sort of like faith or anything based in that world, you know, you at some point have to relinquish authority to the higher planes of your brain's operation, you know, not to be too cognitive neuroscience-y, but your brain has this unconscious operation, and there's this space between your conscious thought and your unconscious thought, and this semi-consciousness is what I believe your intuition is, and your brain is working for you, and looking at all the interactions going on between the left and right brain operations, and when you give it the appropriate time, like you are, Denise, I think the answers will come to you. I think that's the leap of faith you always have to take.
Oh yeah, it'll all sort out, and I know it will. So it's not a stressing thing for me. It's just some going through all the horizons basically, and saying, okay, what is still important to me?
Absolutely. Great. How about you, Nick?
I've been doing. I think I struggled with a long time with getting my GTD system set up, and it's only sort of recently that I'm where I feel like it's in a really good place. and I'm happy with my project and my weekly review is working. And recently, it's sort of been, well, now that things are going well, I need to start making some decisions, and I'm really using it the way it should be used. I need to make choices about what I'm doing based off the things in my system, and I'm learning to use my intuition. I mean, I guess I've always been using my intuition, but in the context of GTD, I'm using it in a different way now, which is you know, it has been a challenge because sometimes I want to do things that are different than that I have in my system or something like that. But it's something I'm working on. So I'll update you on that in the future. And I think obviously the intuition is good once you have. When you predefined your decisions and then you're using intuition about those predefined decisions, that's the place you want to be.
That's great insight. I think that's really important for people to.
That's well said.
One. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the 2 points that I sort of looked out of that is, one, you're always working on it. I don't think you're ever going to get to a place in your life where you feel like you've arrived and you just stay there. Very similar to Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Don't stay in a self-actualized top of a pyramid perspective. You move up and down it, whether that be on a yearly, monthly, or day-to-day basis. And two is that, you know, unlocking it like you're talking about is fantastic in that perspective. You know, making the decision as you're moving yourself forward. So fantastic, wonderful set. So moving on to chapter 14, you know, sort of, or staying in chapter 14, talking about this idea. Does anyone mind sharing the content of their 20,000 foot level, the areas of responsibility sort of area? And while you're looking for yours, if you happen to be looking for yours, I will go ahead and share mine, and hopefully that sort of helps people get an idea. That's page 229. Actually, what I'll do is I'll share David Allen, because that will be probably more helpful than mine. So page 229 in my hardcover version, he gives the examples of the 20,000 feet content. And so under work, he talks about the idea of asset management, quality control, staff development, planning, system design, administrative support, product development, public relations, customer service, client development, and research. So that's in one column. And in the other column, he has life. He has finances, health and vitality, family, career, household, parenting, partnering, recreation, creativity, self-development, and service and spirituality. And so he has these sort of the contents on his 20,000 foot list. And I'm sort of curious if folks have similar or different ways of contextualizing the 20,000 foot level. So how about you, Tom? Well, we'll move on to you.
I'm sorry, I was on mute there.
Oh, sure. Go for it, Tom.
I have my areas of focus, and I just said I blurred the two, but I do have my areas of focus personal and my areas of focus professional on different lists. And I think a lot of our areas of focus professional, they're kind of universal. I mean, you're concerned about your staff and you're concerned about your superiors and you're concerned about your market and your sales, and especially those of us who are entrepreneurs. I thought I might share some of my personal ones. These have kind of evolved over time. I have one area of focus personal for each member of my family. So when I'm doing my weekly review, I think about each of those people individually, my wife, my children. I also have areas of focus for financial things. Some of these are just one word, a mind, financials, hobbies, exercise, health. Church and spiritual. Manners. mission.
I actually have an old-fashioned Covey mission statement that I try to connect to as well when I'm doing my reviews.
Yeah.
It's just basically a list of affirmations. But those are some of my personal ones.
That's fantastic. Thanks for sharing. How about you, Denise?
I have a lot of similar ones with Tom and also on the ones that are on David's list. But I also added one this year just because I, kind of like you, tend to work way too often. And I added fun as one of my sitting out there, so I have to look at it all the time. And so that's on my area of focus for this year.
That's great. So do you have something that you use to sort of trigger yourself to look at it often, or is it a space that you see very frequently?
I have my areas of focus as a mind map, and because of the software, it's on my iPad and it's on my computer, and I tend to look at it usually once a week just as a glance, because it's this nice, you know, I spent some time making this pretty little picture, and so I make myself look at it.
Very cool. Very cool. And how about you, Nick?
I'm using, in my OmniFocus, I have my folder set up by area of focus. So that's how I do it. And so during my weekly review, I go, hey, any projects in development? And I have projects in X. So the way that I kind of use it. Mine are very similar. I have one for productivity.
So do I.
Just keep me up to speed on the productivity sphere of my life. So that's all I really have that's different. I have a bunch of segments under health as well.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, no, I definitely have a productivity category, and that fits under a professional, you know, the subcategory under professional. And I, although productivity touches both my personal and professional life, I tend to keep it in a professional perspective. And so, fantastic. Just for folks who may be listening, and those of you on the call, I'm going to offer some other, what I call sort of contextualities or polarities to look at in terms of when you're outlining your areas of focus to really give yourself some latitude in how you're looking at your relationship with the world and time. And so I tend to look at things from, this is again going probably back to a little more Covey material, an abundance mentality to scarcity mentality. So when you're looking at your different pieces of work and life, how are you coining those particular categories based on an abundance versus scarcity mentality? And of course, Covey would say to lean on the abundance mentality side. Myers-Briggs, and so Dr. Elizabeth Myers-Briggs, you know, if you're looking at it from the four dichotomies, so that is extroversion to introversion, sensing to intuition, thinking to feeling, and judgment to perception. I really like looking at things from that perspective at the 20,000-foot level. You know, where am I in my life? Am I feeling more extroverted right now? Am I feeling more introverted? And how are those polarities really helping me deal with the world? Pleasure, pain, problem versus solution. And many times when we think about problems and solutions, we tend to think about facts versus values. And, you know, facts versus values sometimes are in conflict with one another. I have a report, measure, verify concept, which is the idea of what is truth. Truth is the ability to be able to report, measure, and verify something. And so I love looking at it from that perspective. I think about things in terms of seasons, summer, spring, fall, winter, and then, of course, past, present, future, and trying to blend, you know, have a balance between those three places of mindfulness. So if you're in the present, thinking about the past, in the present, thinking about now, and in the present, thinking about the future, you should be able to balance those thoughts in your 20,000 foot level. And there's lots of other ones that are there, but I tend to use those few. And then senses, you know, if you want to think about the five senses, taste, touch, sight, smell, sound, and then, of course,
of the five tastes, you know, which are sweet, bitter, sour, salt, and umami. So it's like thinking about all of those things sometimes gives your 20,000 foot level a little bit of flavor, not the sweet honey. But you know, I think that it really helps. So moving into the rest of the book, just jumping into chapter 15, how do you determine when it's best to target more or less ambitious goals on the 30,000 foot level? And just for folks listening, the 30,000 foot level, David Allen gives you the question, what do I want to achieve? What do I want to achieve? And this is a really cool question, I think, to ask yourself on this sort of annual basis. You know, what do I want to achieve? And he goes into a little bit of description about you know, how you might want to deal with these things. But I'm curious, for the folks on the line, starting with Tom, how do you determine when it's best to target more or less ambitious goals at that 30,000 foot level?
Well, of course, I'm one of those people that does their, you know, the annual planning and setting your goals, sometimes around New Year's, sometimes around my birthday, which is early in December. So I'm not caught up in just what they call resolutions. It seems to be easy to break and get out of. If I do it before New Year's, it seems like I take those goals a little more seriously. I probably, when I'm looking at goals, I do kind of use that idea that David Allen talks about. It. If you can do them in a year, it's more like a project. If it's more than a year, it's a goal. I don't really visit those too often, maybe once a year. Sometimes in the middle of the year, I might, or at the change of the seasons, I might kind of reevaluate those things. But not too often. Not too often. I'm thinking my goals are pretty long term type things. So I don't find that I have to review them incredibly often.
Wonderful. How about you, Denise?
I would normally say about once a year, but right now I'm reviewing pretty much everything, which is why I started, I mind mapped my areas of focus, and then I put my goals above that. So I kind of built this whole thing out, and it's color coded based on my areas of focus and based on all the way up, so that I kind of see where the balance is and how I want it to work out.
Oh, you know,
normally
how
I would
coding.
Say, it you know, it makes it, it's so nice to just be able to see it. So I say, okay, what kind of projects do I have in this balance? You know, am I balanced, and am I hitting my goals? So right now I'm kind of evaluating everything, and it's mid-year kind of for me, but normally I would say probably only once a year I would review.
Cool. How about you, Nick?
I have recently been getting into the practice of setting monthly goals, and I every week, as part of my weekly review, I check in on them, which has been interesting for me. I know David Allen speaks to the fact that, you know, projects are 1 or more year, or up to a year, and goals are sort of longer term. I think it's helpful just to sit down on a monthly basis, or an quarterly, annual basis, however you like to do it, and set some goals, and then use those to sort of drive projects. It's sort of more of a top-down way to drive your project list, and the outcome of that has been for me that some projects that I had been avoiding wound up back on my project list. So I do think it's helpful. I do think there's some nice interplay between projects and goals that you could benefit from. It's been working well for me. The one thing I've always sort of scratched my head at a little bit is why areas of focus isn't 30K and goals 20K. Just a thought. Because it seems to me that each one of my areas of focus probably has a goal associated with it, but a goal, or, you know, a couple of goals. But just a thought, anyway.
Anyone have any thoughts about Nick's question about the 20,000 foot versus 30,000 foot level? I know.
Well, Nick, I really like your idea of monthly goals. I think that's I really like that a lot, and I just wrote that down here. And I like the idea of systematically taking those areas of focus and attaching goals to them. I think that's a great idea.
Absolutely. That sort of ties me to my monthly category focus concept.
I don't want to go against the Bible here, but I kind of do it that way a little bit. So I put my goals under my areas of focus.
Yeah, for me, I don't particularly care what plane it exists on. I mean, I think that having the areas of responsibility below goals of any kind, I think just ends up being a contextual thought process. Some people will think of it higher or lower than the other. So I think that you thinking of it at the 30,000-foot level as opposed to the 20,000 and swapping those two, I would be completely fine. I actually think that if you moved 20,000 foot all the way up to 40,000 and shifted down 30 and 40, you would still be in an appropriate sort of moving of things upward, except that most often than not, if you're thinking about a runway next action and go up to your project, the next thing up you're going to be thinking about in terms of how do I resolve motivation is probably going to be where you fit in context to things. You know what I mean? So I think that's why you put it in that perspective. I think the answer would be, at least from David Allen, it would be, and not to put words in his mouth, but it would be the typical order of thinking yourself up in that perspective to answer why am I doing this? And
the one thing I could think about from his perspective, and this goes to the topic he keeps on raising in the book, which is what has your attention right now? You know, what is true right now? I think if you sort of, the one risk of putting your goals under horizon, under your areas of focus is, you know, at various points in your life, different areas of focus are more important than others. And it's okay for different areas to sort of take a back burner seat. And maybe that's why he does it that way. So that's my one thought. I guess if you're just free-form writing your goals and not keeping them correlated closely to your areas of focus, there is a sort of, this is what is true for me now, this is what has my attention now, that you might not be getting from a more rigid application. But that's the one thought I had in answer to my own question. But
that's certainly one great potential explanation. You were going to say, Nick?
No, that was it for me. I still think there's benefits to having some goals under each area of focus as well.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, for myself, when it comes to the idea of having more or less ambitious goals on the 30,000-foot level, I find myself in sort of Tom state where I do it on an annual basis. My personal year, I call it personal, and then for business, I call it my fiscal year. So my fiscal year starts September 1, so it's starting, you know, very soon. So all of that preparation to close out my business year and start my new year has already ended and now begun, starting on Tuesday. And the personal year, I do it based on my birth month, which happens to be November, and it also happens to fall in a time of the year where I don't have to spend a lot of energy dealing with anything else. So my fiscal year has already begun and is in full swing, and it allows me the opportunity to go ahead and spend the month of October really planning for my future year. So I use Halloween as my New Year's Eve, and so it gives me an opportunity to work toward a full month of planning the future, you know, year, to celebrate the successes of the current year in my personal life, and then to plan forward for the current year. So November 1 begins my new year, and so I use that time frame as an anchor for really jump-starting new projects and looking at old ones and deciding whether or not those projects are worthy of continuing on or ending, and then starting anew in the new year, November 1. And so it's been a really great ability for me specifically to keep that connection that Nick is really talking about when it comes to areas of focus and areas of responsibility. to the higher levels as well as the lower levels, I always add context of those 20,000-foot level items to all of my next actions in my system as well as all of the higher tiers as well. So every goal upward all the way up to mission, vision, and purpose and principle, those are all including each of those categories. Literally, my mission statement has a statement in there regarding each of those 20,000-foot level items. And I don't think that you can really have a complete mission statement in my head. That is, I can't have a complete mission statement without having each of those things discussed in the mission statement. And then, of course, for my principles, I have an outline of sort of my own personal standard operating procedure. And so it includes, again, each of those items. If I'm doing each of those, if I'm effectively working each of those categories, then I have a framework. I know what I'm going to do and what I'm not going to do in those particular areas from my principles list. And so it's pretty framed for me. But what it really helps me do is connecting those monthly category focuses. So every month is connected to a particular category, high-level category. It allows me to think every day about a particular month, what can I do to move forward that particular area, that particular project, those particular projects that I've planned for this year. And it helps me spend a little bit less time through the month of October really focusing on one category too much. So it just gives me a little bit more of a blended approach to it. And it's usually fun. I usually make a good time of it. So my charitable sort of philanthropy and volunteering monthly category focus, you know, tends to fall in the beginning of the spring. And so it's usually a great time to get out and meet new people and do new things because I spend a day doing something new in terms of the volunteering. And that ends up bleeding into the whole rest of my year because I end up continuing those volunteer roles or charitable roles throughout the following 11 months. So it's usually really fun. All right, so we have quite a bit more to discuss, so let's jump right on to my next question, which is at the 40,000-foot level, David Allen states that the primary question to ask here is, if you were wildly successful in the coming years, what do you imagine or see yourself doing or being, end quote. So have you asked yourself this question? David Allen says you don't have to, consciously at least. And if you have, how often do you ask yourself that question? So let's start with Tom.
Well, I would say that whenever I'm doing my goal setting, I'm doing that visualization, you know, of where would I like to be in the coming year if I was wildly successful. And I have found that sometimes even without planning those, just by serendipity, those things will sometimes happen. It's really quite wonderful when it does. But that's definitely the exception, not the rule. I don't systematically do that vision-making thing except when I'm really doing my goals. I try to keep, of course, my, as they say, the eye on the prize, but I don't really go back and visit that a whole lot.
Cool. How about you, Denise?
I don't visit it very much. I do once a year for the business side, but on the personal side, it's on my list to kind of somehow create a project around that to decide really what I want to have in that.
Definitely. How about you, Nick?
I think this is important. I think I do a good job of internally envisioning sort of success and envisioning what it is that I want for myself. Maybe you guys, I'm sure you guys do as well. I don't know if it needs to be written down as my 3-year plan is to have this amount of income, and you know, I don't know if that's really helpful, but I think just picturing what it is that I want and what it looks like and feels like is something that I'm pretty good at. So that's sort of how I think about it.
Yeah, I tend to do this at the 40,000 foot level for only a couple of my categories, you know, so, you know, like retirement, finances, those types of things tend to be looked at on a long-term perspective. about, for instance, a subcategory like creativity or personal improvement or those types of things, typically will not be on such a long-term span because those are things that are much more right brain, much more emotive, emotional for me. So, you know, they'd be things that I would think about on a much shorter-term basis. So I wouldn't want to plan that out long-term. It doesn't seem very spontaneous to be creative or to think about your creativity, 30 years from now or whatever it might be. So, but retirement probably does need to be. So I think choosing the appropriate categories that do need long-term planning, you know, parenting, education, retirement, those things are appropriate to be thinking about on that longer-term level in the context of saying things as yourself wildly successful. So I tend to look at it from that sort of perspective. And so since we're running out of time, I want to sort of close out with Chapter 19. David Allen posits that the quality of the tools and process in an organization is where the vast majority of improvement in productivity happens, paraphrasing his words. So do you believe that's the case for the individual? That the tools and the process is where the vast majority of your personal improvement in productivity happens? So we'll go from the bottom to the top. Nick.
Well, I think about this in terms of my experience with it, and I think the funny thing about GTD is it's sort of you spend all this time cleaning up your runway and getting your systems in place, and when you finally start to get it, you are focusing more on the things that you would have just written down on the list as the top five things that I need to focus on. Like it's a very sort of circular way of getting back to what's important. You know, if you had just sat down on day one instead of cleaning up your inbox and said these are the five things that you really need to focus on, you know, going through this whole process of from the ground up organizing and then, you know, getting everything where it needs to be organized, all your commitments clear, you'd probably come up in your weekly review with something similar. But you have, having gone through all of that, a sense of control and perspective that you otherwise would not have had before. So I think those are my sort of thoughts on having done GTD for a while. And I don't know if that really answered your question, but those are the thoughts that came to mind.
No, it's a really great perspective on why to do GTD in the first place. I think that makes a lot of sense. I think you're basically answering yes with an asterisk. So I think that's great, and those are great footnotes. How about you, Denise?
I think the tools are important, but I think you have to get to a spot with your tools are just in the background. So you're not continually, you know, tinkering with your system or going down the productivity porn app route or, you know, getting yourself caught running down a rabbit hole chasing out the latest and greatest whatever when, you know, apps and tools and things like that only go so far. They just need to be supporting what you're doing.
Absolutely. Great thought. How about you, Tom?
You know, GTD has always been kind of tool agnostic. They just, you know, they don't really talk about the particular tools you use. It's always been kind of, as it's evolved over the years, people have started embracing all the digital tools. And I'm addicted to productivity porn. I changed list makers and all that. And especially over the last couple of years, I have. Since I got an iPhone, it's just been like insane. Over the last 6 months, though, I have not. I've kind of stuck with Evernote, and I have incorporated just a regular notebook that I just a little Moleskine that I carry around. So yeah, I think the tools are secondary. I think habits are the most important things to me to do GTD. It's all about just the discipline and the habit of going through the process. If you do that, I think the tools are just really secondary because all they are is just a way to document in writing or in some physical form what you're thinking about. And that can be as sophisticated or as rudimentary as you want it to be.
Fantastic.
I was just going to say, I really enjoyed making it all work. I think I liked it. You know, I've read Getting Things Done several times, and I found making it all work. This is really my first time spending a lot of time with it, and I just thought it was refreshing and a great way to look at things, a different perspective on the whole system. And I think it really added to my GTD toolkit, so to say. And I'm grateful for having taken the time with it. I would recommend it. I would recommend that people read this first before getting things done. Having read it, which is maybe crazy to some people, but those are my thoughts.
No, I think that's a fantastic thought process. I think that I've in the past given the advice that if someone is probably more right-brained, they feel like they're much more of a creative or emotional person, that they should probably stick to reading Making It All Work and then backflowing themselves into the process of getting things done. And then those people who are more analytical thinkers, so if you think Kiersey temperament sorter, if you're a driver analytical thinker, you know, those two quadrants, social styles, you probably want to do GTD first. If you're an amiable or an analytical thinker, you probably want to do Making It All Work first. So it's sort of how I split it up in terms of those things. If you have any questions about that, you could probably message me privately, and I can give you thoughts on where that fits in terms of Myers-Briggs perspective or even an Enneagram perspective when it comes to that. But yeah, I think that certain people lend toward either book first or second. Although I'm much more of a GTD person, I found Making It All Work a really valuable read for me, especially having practiced the system for so many years that once I got to Making It All Work in 2011, I really found it to be an amazing, you know, sort of thought process along with David Allen. You know, I've been using the system, I've been seeing it work, I've been seeing parts of it not work, and the clarifications are really helpful. Having those questions at each of the levels of perspective were really, really helpful for me, and actually in this rereading were even more helpful for me because it really stood out this time around that it didn't the last time around. So I was really appreciative of that.
I just wanted to thank everybody's participation in this series of calls because I've read the book a couple times and I've been practicing GTD for nearly a decade, and I have gotten so many wonderful insights from sharing all this with you guys. So I just wanted to say thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank wonderful. You as well. It's
wonderful.
And Denise.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Everybody. All right, well, continuing the tradition here on Productivity Book Group to end every call with my favorite quotation from our book reading collection, here it is. Quote, the best indicator for achieving control and perspective, pay close attention to what most has your attention, end quote. That's something that David Allen says over and over again in the book, and I think it makes most sense because paying close attention to what most has your attention will usually unlock the answer for you as to what you should be doing. Well, that finishes out this Productivity Book Group discussion, and of course it finishes out Making It All Work. So as Tom said before, thank you everyone for this conversation over these last three calls about Making It All Work. It's really been a fantastic journey. I have a few announcements. First, our next Productivity Book Group call will take place on Saturday, September 14th, and that will be at, again, noon Eastern Time, so September 14th, and we will be discussing the 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, Powerful Lessons in Personal Change by the late Dr. Stephen R. Covey, and we'll be reading in that call on September 14th, Part 1. So we'll be going through the first 4 habits. All information about Productivity Book Group is posted to productivitybookgroup.org, and the podcasts are archived there under episodes. So feel free to check them out if you've missed an episode. We've now completed the trilogy, so to speak, the GTD trilogy. We've completed Getting Things Done, Ready for Anything, the 52 Productivity Principles, and now Making It All Work. So we have the body of that work there. I hope you'll all be able to join us for the live call on September 14th at noon Eastern Standard Time, and or subscribe in iTunes or elsewhere to listen to the archive. Finally, if you've enjoyed being on the live call or listening to the podcast, please review us in iTunes. It helps build our community here at Productivity Book Group. The more the merrier on the live calls, obviously. Thank you, everyone. Here's to your productive life. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, Ray.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.